I got to jump in, guys, because we have to get to our listener questions. I know you guys could ask Dave questions all day long. We didn't even get to his diet. Dave, real quick, what was your diet again at your biggest? It was how many ounces of meat and how much rice?
1 kilo dry weight rice a day, 3 kilos of meat a day, 1 kilo of broccoli a day, and about 500 grams of oats.
I think the food had something to do with it too. It's just back to back.
You know you're
back.
Eating when you measure your food in kilos. Hey everybody, welcome to It's Just Bodybuilding. Big Ron Partlow here. Dusty Henshaw in that corner. The producer Scott McNally in that corner. And today we've got Dave Crossland, Scott's co-host over on Drugs and Stuff. How's it going, Dave?
It's going well. Yeah.
It's great to have you on the show, man. I'm looking forward to asking some questions and chatting about some non-bodybuilding stuff, which I'm sure you're quite excited about. I got to remind everybody to like, share, subscribe, comment, and...
ring the bell. I felt like waiting for it today.
And remember, IamMutant.com, Mutant, real supporters of the show, born hardcore. Go to IamMutant.com, get your ISO surge, get your all in, and everybody should get on the gear. Dusty 20, Big Ron 20, save yourself some money, get yourself some good sups. No BSing around. So Dave, what's new, man?
Not much, to be fair. Same different day.
It was great to finally meet you in England. I got to meet you at the booth in the UK, which was good. You know, you're a real... You know, a lot of Scott's friends aren't actually real. They're figments of his imagination.
They're just like other accounts, other profiles that I set up, you know?
I book the trend where the camera puts 10 pounds on you. I look 10 pounds heavier in real life.
You are a big man. You're a big dude. What do you actually weigh? How tall are you and what do you actually weigh?
I'm a fat man. Let's get this right. I'm a very fat man.
But very tall also.
Dense bones, big boned.
Yeah, I'm big boned. Yeah, it's glandular.
It's husky.
You guys know Dave was jacked. Dave was like a massive dude. One of the things I want to make sure we talk about today with him is bouncing, because I know you and Dusty, all of you guys have had bouncing experience, and I know Dave's got some stories. I'm going to show you guys a picture of what Dave looked like not too long ago. This is Dave at his best when he had his arms all oiled up.
That's a great job with the oil, though. I'll be honest. They look fantastic.
Yeah, I've made it look really smooth, haven't I?
How big did your arms measure there? Did you put a tape around them?
So my biggest was 26 and a half with a 74-inch chest.
That's absurd.
And how tall are you?
6'1".
So you're just like my height. God damn. So, I mean, I know you said you oiled your arms, you experimented with all sorts of stuff.
No, I was joking. People always give him crap and they'll comment and they'll be like, you guys photoshopped that guy's arms, or you guys, you know, that guy just is all oil. And so
I was so impressed with your use of the oil. Now I'm actually a little disappointed. It's muscle.
I didn't realize you guys were being sarcastic.
I was very impressed. I was like, you know, that's well done.
I know you. And I was like, no, they're not even red. You know,
his always skin is so light; they would have bruised like crazy. I mean, I was very impressed.
Right?
Yeah.
I'm disappointed. You having real mass has ruined all of this for me.
I'd always cited, but I'd never used synthol in my arms. I never needed to, for God's sake.
Obviously. you know, I was going to do the same thing, Dave, because my biceps were terrible. So I was like, well, I'll just sight hit them. And it was the one, like one of the muscles of my body that was like, don't you dare. It was sore for days. I can knock the hell out of the whole body. Calves and biceps, don't touch them. They were not friendly. The calf was really bad. The bicep, I was like, I did it for a minute because I was like, it's fine. I'll put up with the pain. And then I started thinking, I'm going to tear a bicep deadlifting.
Yeah.
I better stop. So I stopped.
Calves are definitely an experience. I quite like doing calves, but they are definitely an experience. I was obsessed with getting big calves. Like most people are obsessed with big abs or big. Me, it was calves. Always wanted monstrous calves.
I wanted big calves in my house too, so I got married to a girl that had big calves.
He just went and got himself a wife that has monstrous calves. Calves boxy. What did you think of the Arnold UK, Dave?
You know what? I thought it was a good show. We don't get the sort of American influence like normally. So to actually like you guys being there, Miss Olympia being there, there was a lot of big names that we would never normally see. And even in the previous Arnolds that were franchises, we just didn't see the American brands. So it worked really well with it being packaged off the back of the American Arnolds because they sort of got a lot of brands to come with it. It was stand-wise, could have been better. There were definitely some obvious very big spaces where they just hadn't sold space. But as a show, I thought it delivered, definitely from an athlete point of view, definitely from the people being there. I mean, Vizis was there. Obviously, Jamie was with you guys, but Diamond was there as well. And obviously, Gladiators is quite a big thing over here now. But yeah, there were a lot of big names. There were a lot of who's who of the various industries there. And actually, I thought it, went very, very well. Could have done with a bit more trade from that point of view, but you can't have it all.
So, what about the podcast viewers? You get people coming up to you asking you about DNS and all that.
I mean, you're
pretty easy to recognize.
I find it really weird. I say this to Scott. I don't know if he believes me or not. I don't understand why people tune in to watch that shit week after week. I genuinely don't get it. It's like, why the fuck would you? How bad is your life that you actually want to sit and listen to me for an hour and a half every week? Jesus, go get a hobby or something. I mean, this is just terrible. So it continually amazes me that people do genuinely watch it and generally enjoy it.
I think you've done a lot of the crazy stuff that they all wish they could have tried. You know what I mean? Yeah, Dave definitely has contributed with some self-experimentation to a level that most people are like, damn, that would be fun. You know, but they just can't quite commit.
They don't need to because he did.
Yeah, please don't, guys, don't. Yeah.
Lessons learned is the point of this show. Let's just slow it down a notch.
Throw that one picture back up, Scott, the one of him in the chair. I don't think you put that on when we were on air yet.
All right.
There we go, that one. What do you weigh there?
385-ish.
At 6'1". God damn.
Yeah, I topped out at 415. Oh. At 4, I still look like I lifted weight. At 415, I look like I should have been rolled back into the ocean.
Throw a bucket of water on you to keep you alive.
Well, so, I think there was more water in me than there would have been in the bucket, to be fair, at that point. But then that was at that point my kidneys were failing and everything was going south pretty rapidly.
So, Dave, when you were pushing, and this is kind of a known thing, drugs bore me. How was the training? Like, did you have lower back tightness on everything you did? Did you feel good? I mean, like, the training itself, where were you there? Because I figure between the food and everything, you know, when was the point where you started sacrificing the ability to train hard because of the, I don't even know what to call them, the effects of being that big?
I would have said probably 375, 385, somewhere in that period was where the crossover. And I noticeably started to see. So at 415, I was weaker than I was at 365.
Right.
I was a lot bigger, but there were a couple of exercises that I could move more on. But in general, I wasn't as strong. Now, at 365, I could train fast and I could train hard. Mm-hmm. I would come out of 6-7 plate squats, 90 seconds, and I was back under and going again. You know, that was the sort of pace I always kept. So it was very on-off. It was still heavy load, and it was just bang, bang, bang. When I started to go over the 375 mark, I started to lose that, and those 90-second gaps were becoming a minute, and were becoming like a couple of minutes, 3 minutes, 4 minutes. Right. And I was blowing like an old cart horse between sets. surprisingly to most people, at 365, I could still move pretty good. Mm-hmm. And I could train hard and I could train quick. But yeah, the training did definitely start going downhill. I also mentally sort of lost direction around then as well. Mm-hmm. I've always had this, I don't know if it's a weird approach, but probably a slightly different approach than a lot of people do when they've been around drugs for a long time. The drugs were always a tool. They were all something I did to achieve a goal. They were never the goal. They were never the main factor. The main factor of me was always been training.
Right.
I only took drugs because I wanted to train harder. That was my motivation around starting steroids, was because I wanted to train harder and I knew the drugs would allow me to do that. It was never to get big. That was a byproduct of training harder. But around the 375 mark was where my mindset slipped and I started to be very drug-driven. And then it was all about what drugs could I take, how could I get bigger with more drugs, and I lost sight of what was my core love and the core behind it all, which for me has always been training. I all through my training have sort of fantasized about how can I train harder, how can I make this more intense, how can I make this exercise more difficult. That's always been what I've wanted in the gym. And that's always been my primary driver. I would train whether I had drugs. I would train whether I had good food. It didn't matter as long as I could train. And that shifted.
So when that shift took place, was part of it experimenting also? Like actually seeing, not just for yourself, but in general? Just because I find it interesting because, like you said, your foundation was training. For something to shift that much that you lost track, like you just said a minute ago, I mean, your training dipped down 50 pounds below your peak weight.
Yeah, I mean, I peaked at 415, but I suppose really my peak weight of any consequence was 400.
Right.
The 415 was 15 pounds of just water. There was no other way, so it was. It was a gradual thing. I've always felt I've had a pretty good grasp on me. I'm being quite real about who I am and what I am capable of and what I'm not capable of. I'm quite open about where my mistakes are and where my problems are in my own behaviors. I just caught myself having conversations in my head. I used to sit and devise workout plans continuously. And how could I intensify that? And where did I take the foot off the gas on that? And could I got a little bit more out of that if I'd done X, Y, Z? And spent a lot of time mentally focusing and mentally training myself to hold form under the most extreme of effort. And that took a lot of years and a lot of discipline to get to that point where I could be giving everything I had but still hold form. And that started to slip, and I just found myself thinking more and more about drugs. And I caught myself, and I remember it to this day. It was 3 o'clock in the morning. I was sat on the toilet doing a GH injection at 3 a.m. because I was pulsing it.
Perfect timing.
And I sat there and I just went, what the fuck am I doing? Right. And at that point there and then was, this is it. This is done. I'm here for the wrong reasons.
Right. Just too much going on.
And that was the end of it. And then quite literally a week later, I was admitted with kidney failure. And shortly after that, I started getting heart problems. I mean, I went into it very open. You know, I was very open with what I was, risks I was putting myself at and everything else. And I was quite happy to accept it. I mean, even now, I mean, I'm trashed, but I don't have any woe is me or I regret this or regret. I don't regret a second of it.
Right.
So, like Dusty said, that the training. So, you know, people will say, oh, it take, you know, you get guys that are 210 pounds telling everyone else how to get massive, right? Or guys that are, you know, 190 telling everyone how to truly train for hypertrophy, But I look at you at 6'1" and, you know, getting up over 400 pounds. Okay, let's even say your body fat was too high and you had a ton of water on you. So what? You're still 360? So, so the, you know, just looking at the raw numbers of how huge you were, what did you learn about what put the size on the most in the gym? Like, what were you, you know, because a lot of guys top out at 300. I mean, I got to 330 and it was everything I was doing. I mean, I could have taken way more drugs than I did, but, you know, I had my own speed limits. But as far as food and training, like, I don't know what else I could have done to get bigger. What did you get the that, you know, you 340, 350, 360, 370, 380? I mean, like, what was going on in the gym?
I am very, it's probably, I don't know if it's the right word, spiritual about my training. I'm a big form junkie. Well, actually, no, I'm a big engagement junkie. Form's probably the wrong word. So for me, it was all about being as effective as I could in engaging the target muscle in the movement I was doing. And that was a continual challenge. So I, and that evolved. So originally it was just, you know, getting the muscle and feeling it. Then it was about building up the pain tolerance to endure the level of pain you were going to generate when you were engaging that well. And then there was always this appetite for pushing the limit. And a lot of people, I don't think they actually understand what failure is, because most people don't fail. They stop and fail mentally because they don't think they can get another rep. Where I would go down whatever exercise it was, you know, that next rep, the negative would be completed. And when it came to the positive, I would start. And if it didn't move, I just stayed in position and kept pushing.
Right.
So it was things like that. And I worked a lot on mentally focusing on what I was doing completely and totally. So the only thing in my head was the muscle I was working and how it moved and how it was attached and what it was actually doing and how it was contracting in that movement. I got to the point, I didn't count sets, didn't count reps. I kept a track of weight just for progression, but it was a very connective thing when I was training. In I didn't judge my set or my rep on the number I did or the weight I did. I judged it on how it felt and how that engagement felt and how deep I could feel that recruiting tissue. And I got to the point where I was literally, I wasn't consciously trying to pull in a movement. I was trying to almost just contract. And I know that sounds a bit wrong, but it was like, rather than try and pull the dumbbell up in a bicep curl, I was trying to just flex the bicep with no real consciousness about there being a load in my hand.
Right.
So I'd flex the bicep. The bicep would move, and then in turn, that would move the load.
Right.
You mentioned like 6-7 plate squats. Was that, were you training like, you know, if you step back and look at all the loads you were using, were they all huge like that? Or were you doing some stuff with 30-pound dumbbells as well?
I didn't find that huge.
Right. Most people, it's I'm saying.
Yeah, but it's relative, isn't it? So to me, you know, I'm 365 pounds and I'm stepping out with 300 kilo on my back. But a guy at 240 stepping out with 250 kilo, 240 kilo was more impressive to me.
Right.
Because he's actually, you know, he's squatting much more in relation to his body weight. So though the total weight seemed big looking in, relative, I didn't think they were that big. There was a few things. I never allowed myself to have any limits. And I always surrounded myself with people who were way, way stronger than me. So when I squatted in my early days, I squatted with powerlifters. They would do two reps, I would do eight. But my headspace was they were using the same weight as me, or I was using the same weight. The reps didn't come into it. It was just about the load. And I forced myself to almost not allow myself to limit what I was doing. Mm-hmm. So, like, I'd do a pec deck, and I'd do the stack, like a straight arm pec deck. I'd do the stack with two people stood on it. Because I didn't visualize it that, though, that's a pec deck, you can't go heavy. Why can't I go heavy? All it is the movement that my muscle's doing. The type of exercise makes no frigging difference to what I'm doing. It's how the muscle moves that's important, and I apply as much load to that movement as I can, maintaining control and form. So, yeah, I suppose there were big numbers, but they didn't seem it to me at the time. They were just what I did. My reps were always slow. They were always controlled. I mean, I you'd never see a bar bounce. You'd never see any speed in anything I did. I didn't explode reps. It was all just almost piston-like, almost hydraulic-like.
Right.
And that's how my brain was working with it as well. It was muscle engage, muscle pull, muscle release. You know, it was that sort of robotic approach to what I was doing, in a sense of the smoothness of the movement. I mean, at any rate, any rep, I could stop at any point and then restart and go the opposite way, or whatever you wanted me to do with it. That was the sort of level control I forced to have. Mm-hmm. And I think as I tried to continue progression, I constantly, rather than looking to move more load, I looked to get more out of the load I was doing.
Right.
But I would start squatting with an empty bar, and then I'd do a plate, then I'd do two plates, then I'd do three plates, and it wouldn't be till I got to the four plates I could get the bar on my back properly.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, you're barely able to get your hands on the bar at that point. Yeah,
I needed that weight to settle it in. But so, did I do light work? Yeah, I still did a lot of time under tension stuff. But I just got stupidly strong in weird movements. I mean, I'd sit on a bench with a 85-pound dumbbell in my hand and do a seated lateral raise in perfect form.
Ooh. Right.
I'd sit on a preacher bench and do a single-arm dumbbell curl with 9,500-pound dumbbells, super stretched, fully straight, all the way up. But you give me a barbell, and I'd struggle to curl more than 20 kilo a side.
Because you're really good at the movements that you were using, because you like those movements.
Yeah, but it was all about – it was never about load for load's sake. It was all about the stimulus. My driving factor in everything was about the stimulus. You know, it wasn't about how I could move more weight. It was about how I could make that hurt more, how I could stimulate the muscle harder, how I could make that more difficult to do. And a lot of that came from focus. I was mentally exhausted after workouts, let alone physically.
Do you think that that's a thing that has gotten lost a little bit because of the amount of information overload we have? It's something we talk about on the show all the time, but you know, I'll have people reach out and say, oh, I saw your skull crushers. When I do those, every time I do them, they hurt my elbows. And my reaction is always, well, why are you doing something that hurts your elbows? It's not a magical movement. I feel like that's something that we can't push out enough. And I'm glad you said it, which was you were doing the movements that worked for you to get your desired result. And I feel like that gets lost because I don't really care. Like, I mean, I'm trying to think of someone off the top of my head, Max Charles. He used to always put up videos and the range of motion was super short. I mean, the depth was short, the contraction was short, and people would say, that's terrible. And I was like, look at him.
Right.
It's not terrible. So what do you think that's gotten lost a bit? And how do you think guys should focus on paying attention? Even when you're writing their routine, it's like a guy should be able to say to you, hey, Dave, the squats, I don't get any contraction out of them. Well, then what do you get contraction out of?
I would work on exercises I didn't get on with just for the sheer bloody-mindedness of it. But I think two things have happened. Well, more than two things have happened. One is people don't know how to train, but they think they do. It's overly regulated. So I might upset someone here. I don't really give a shit. But it's like, what the fuck is a deload week? And why is it scheduled?
Right.
So from my point of view, if I'm starting to have a lack of progress in the gym, or I'm starting to see niggles creeping or something else, I would review what I do, but I wouldn't plan a deload week every 8 weeks.
Right.
I would back off and maybe go a higher rep and lighter weight for a couple of sessions or maybe a week if I felt I needed it. And nobody seems to have the intellect to be able to interpret that anymore. It's all got to be planned. It's all got to be structured. And it's like,
spreadsheet
why?
Bodybuilding.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I love that term. I got to jump in, guys, because we have to get to our listener questions. I know you guys could ask Dave questions all day long. We didn't even get to his diet. Dave, real quick, what was your diet again at your biggest? It was how many ounces of meat and how much rice?
1 kilo dry weight rice a day, 3 kilos of meat a day, 1 kilo of broccoli a day, and about 500 grams of oats.
And you split it all up, like, what was, like, one meal? Because I know you're eating, like, every hour on the hour.
300 grams of meat, 100 grams of rice, 10 meals a day.
I think the food had something to do with it, too. It's just back to back.
You know
back.
You're eating when you measure your food in kilos.
Yeah. Well, the other thing is their money.
Yeah, yeah.
how much money do you have? 1,000 pounds.
Yeah, you know when you're weighing your money.
If you, yeah, you're not those kind of
money,
pounds.
You're counting your money by weight. Yeah, you're rolling at that point.
Yeah, it's with the food. A lot of people said, "Well, it's easy for you. You've got a big appetite." Meal six onwards was force fed. I mean, I was literally spoonful water, spoonful retching, nearly throwing up, dry retching. They were forced in every day. That food was forced in. Yeah. It wasn't a case of, oh yeah, this is, yeah, no, it was hard going. And unless you've ever lived that, you have no comprehension of what that feels like.
Yeah. Agreed. Before we hit the listener questions, I just want to confirm that even though I, you know, didn't get to 450 and I got to 330, I talk to younger bodybuilders about this all the time. I have young kids send me their diets and they're on like these, what I consider low calorie diets that they're trying to make gains on. Like, oh, my carbs are 175 a day and my protein's 160. And I'm like, oh, I just, that's not what we were doing when we were 300 plus at all, you know? And people just, they think it's all just a calculator. I mean, it's not how it works. Okay.
Agreed. Scott, fire away.
All right. So we got a bunch of them. Dusty put out a thread. Plus, we had like the last two shows. We had just a bunch of questions. So I'm just going to pull from the top here. Oh, we had some from Patreon too. All right. Related to training. So it'll be a good segue here. Question for the next podcast. Do you guys think it's possible to go to the dark place needed to push a set to real failure without tapping into trauma from the past? I have no issues with tapping into it, but I find that it affects me for a few hours after I leave the gym before I snap out of it. Wanted to get your guys' thoughts.
I think the dark place stuff is overplayed and when I think of like the hardest sets I ever did, like the heaviest sets of squats and stuff. And I use the term dark place. I'm thinking of like knocking guys' helmets off on the football field and that sort of thing. I'm not thinking of like, you know, getting abused by a bully or wanting to take revenge on some guy who like hurt my feelings. Like it never went like that. I always thought that was weird when people went that direction. I was like, huh? That I don't think about that stuff at all. It's like positive dark, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Like I think, oh, if I was John Wick, how would I handle things? You know, like
that was lighter weight than you're using, I'm pretty sure.
You know what I mean? So I just think this whole like go to your trauma thing, I'm like, that's not what I ever meant when I used the phrase dark place.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more because I think that I understand how it got misconstrued a little bit. Because I'll still say that during a set, I say go dark, but I'm really just talking about, like, in my brain, go dark is shut the world off. You're here. You're in this moment. Because when yes. I'm in the gym, especially at this point in life, like, I feel very fortunate. I'm not there, like, bringing home. I mean, shit, I had a great childhood. I got nothing to bring. I mean, like, you know, so for me, when I'm thinking that, it's just like, shut the world off. Because when, you know, I've always said that when you walk into the gym, that's that, to me, that's the safe place where you leave your business and your relationship troubles and all these things in the parking lot. You've got your 2 hour solace from that and you stay focused. I mean, that's really what it means. And be fortunate to do that. So yeah, I've never had to feel emotionally exhausted afterwards. I think the darkest thing that I would ever even think about that would even cross your mind is something in a positive way, more like I do think there's a power to having people that doubt you, whether it's in business or whatever, just as a little nudge to yourself when you're getting a little lazy. Just like, oh, but wait a minute. There is that guy that said I couldn't do this, so I should probably do this.
I feel like I you know what? I did do this for a while, though, guys. Like, I tapped into, it was like I got clean and I got back into lifting. And then I started, I'd go to the gym and I just like let out all of these like intense emotions that I had because I was still like sorting through a lot of stuff in my head. And and I found that after a while that I would like try to like work myself up into it. You know what I mean? Like I tried to like take myself back there. And after a while I was like, well, my life got good. You know what I mean? And after my life started getting good, it was like, it was harder to do that. And now for me, I like your definition, Dusty, because you said like dark place, it means like let's go dark. You know what I mean? Like shutting up.
Like when the SEALs,
get off my phone.
When the Navy SEALs pull down the night vision.
Yeah.
It's like
we're going dark. Yeah. You know,
they're still having fun though.
Yeah.
What would Scott call on now? Like last night's apple was a little bit soft.
Yeah, Trader Joe's really ripped me off.
they increased the price of the Granny Smith. I mean, I don't know.
I'm grateful to have good workouts now, and I go to a light place. You know what I mean?
Right.
But I think, remember James Hollingshead long
ago? Yeah, he talked back, about that.
And he talked about it. He's like, I can't go to that dark place anymore. He's like, because it just sticks with me. He was like, and that was years ago. He's made a whole heck of a lot of progress since then without having to do that. And I'll add this. I think that if you force yourself to keep reliving past traumas, that's not going to be healthy for you. Like you are literally you, if you relive a past trauma, you're feeling that again. I wouldn't intentionally go out of my way to force yourself to do that day after day after day. That's not going to be good for you, you know?
Right.
Agreed. I think a lot of it is how that motivates you as well, though. So there's, like you said, there's the doubter thing where someone's been negative towards you. And it's like, well, I'll show you, you fucker. I remember having the piss taken out because I couldn't shoulder press more than one plate aside behind the neck.
That's an F-bomb. Keep going.
Keep it rolling.
The long term result of that was five plates behind the neck.
Right.
So that was driven, but it was driven in a positive way rather than I did use things that life threw at me, or my training partner used a lot of my insecurities in the early day. But all that did for me was make me not insecure about those things anymore.
Right. Yeah.
So it was actually quite therapeutic. As it went on, I got more into God, this sounds so corny when you say it out loud. I never thought I'd be saying this today. But I got into a more fantasy sort of role thing where the sets was me sort of fighting me, but it all became about me trying to beat me, endure this, you know, summoning a dark power sort of thing to get through. But it wasn't in any way dealing with, you know, bad shit. It was all a sort of made up thing, but almost playing a role, but fully committing to that in that I was this warrior machine in the gym that was going to, you know, give everything I could out of this sort of scenario.
Yeah. I saw a psychologist. I can't remember if it was on Lex Friedman or on Rogan or one of the podcasts that I check out. But she was talking about the epidemic of anxiety and depression with young people.
Yeah.
And she was saying that one of the major massive drivers with all this anxiety everyone has is that they keep talking about it.
Yep.
Over and over with, and it's part of their identity now. They're like, oh, well, I have anxiety. It's like, quit talking about it. Just move on. Like, that's part of the problem. They're in a Facebook group for anxiety, and they're in a group with their friends for anxiety, and they're constantly talking to their therapist about anxiety, and they're seeing a therapist about their anxiety, and it just never, ever ends. And that's part of the reason why it gets so out of control.
Yeah.
And so you just, like, you got to just move on. Like, shit happens. Like, go to your squats. Like, yeah. You know what I mean?
Go to your squats.
Yeah. Yeah.
The only thing that gave me anxiety around the gym was squats.
Yeah. It was leg day. Yeah.
All right. Yeah. I was nervous about leg day 2 days before.
Yeah. Train legs so hard that leg day is your biggest problem.
How about this one, guys? So somebody asked us, does Nick Walker have, what does he say here exactly? I'm going to get the exact wording. He says, first, just bodybuilding. Does Nick Walker have a small chest? Seen his most recent, most muscular inside chest. Let's see. With his arms and delts are very dominant and sort of make his pecs look small relatively. And he also added he's a huge Nick Walker fan. So I grabbed a picture. I grabbed one of his latest shots, one of his famous basement shots. Like,
I don't know.
I got nothing.
Yeah. He looks crazy.
Yeah, he looks nuts, man. I think
his head
looks
small.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a small head. How's that? Nick Walker's got a small head. There you
and
go.
It's actually a a size 9 head. It's just he's that big.
Yeah.
And also, everybody's got slightly different proportions. Like, you know, Lee Priest structurally had really huge delts and arms in relation to just this, the circumference of his pec. It wasn't like his pec was small. It was just structurally he had a smaller rib cage. And people often said Lee's chest was small, but he was also top 6 at the Olympia at 5'4". So whatever.
Yeah.
Like, you know, everyone's different. But nah, and Nick's chest isn't a problem to me. I've never once looked at it and thought it was an issue.
All right. Jim McDonald's got one for us. He says, when a person sees one of their favorite bodybuilders in person, what is appropriate in terms of coming up and introducing yourself? Is it cool to ask for a picture in the gym? What if he or she is mid-workout?
It's best etiquette to wait until they appear like they're done training. That's just the best etiquette, ideally. You know, unless they're standing there talking, like maybe they're done chest and they're filling their water bottle and they're chatting with some guy and they got a big smile on their face and they look approachable. I mean, you got to have some kind of social skills to like judge that. But if he's at the squat rack putting plates on the bar and he's got his headphones down, he's going like this, leave him alone. Best advice. And don't bother people when they're sitting at a table eating. Yeah. That's like the worst because they got to get up and interrupting their conversation and all that. Wait for them to be paying their bill and leaving.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean?
For some reason, yeah. I thought you meant like if they're eating their meal after they trained at the gym.
Oh, no. If they're sitting at the bar at the gym eating, talking to people, that's fine. But if you see them in a restaurant talking with their friends or their family or whatever, wait until they get up and they're leaving or whatever.
Yeah. I was going to add one thing to in the gym, just because I've had a couple of people do it and I thought it was great, is I had a guy come up and I was resting and fine. He said, hey, I don't want to bother you, but I'd like to get a picture before you go. And I said, perfect. And in one instance, I was like, well, let's just do it now. And another instance, I was going to leave and I said, oh, wait, where's that guy? Yeah. And I found him to take the picture, because you also don't want to, like, you know, I would hate to sneak out of the gym and not knowing they were there. So, you know, I do have no issue with that, because that puts it back in that person's hands. And I'll be honest, man, for as long as I've been at this, if anybody wants to chat for a quick second or get a quick picture, it's actually really humbling that someone actually cares. So I'm like, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I will add that I was always very easy for pictures, even if I was in the middle of my hard workout. I didn't care. I also took it as a privilege. But, you know, if just saying be not mindful. Everyone. Yeah. Be mindful. Be mindful. That's all.
Just remember they're people, you know, they're not, they're not an item. They're not a commodity. They are people. And training is their job and part of their life, and give them the same respect you expect to be given to you. Mm-hmm. It amazes me that when people get famous in whatever, people start to think that they're public property. They right. start yeah. to think that they own a piece of them. And it's like, you know, they're still people. Give them the respect they deserve. You yeah. wouldn't walk up on someone you don't know in a restaurant and sit down and start asking them questions in the middle of the meal. But why do you think that's okay to do it with somebody who's a bodybuilder?
Right.
Well, we witnessed that. Dusty and I witnessed that with Jamie when we were in England. He's like TV famous yeah. now, right?
Mm-hmm. At our table.
Yeah, we were at a steakhouse, like a nice steakhouse, you know, where the steaks are like $80, $100 a steak. Like, we're at that type of restaurant, and we're all sitting down, a big table, like 12 of us. And people just started coming over to the table in the middle of dinner and asking, and not even really asking, but just saying, I need a picture with you. Mm. And Jamie's like, you know, you guys fork in his hand, like looking up like that.
That's tough. And
me and Dusty were like, these people just have no idea what they're doing. Like, they're just like starstruck.
If Jamie like said, no, I'm trying to have a meal right now, can you respect that? Then he would be a jerk. You know what yep. I mean? Yep. It's like, yeah.
I've got one question off the back of that. How do I get invited to a mutant steakhouse?
you just got to hang around the booth long enough that yeah. everyone just assumes you're part of the crew.
I would actually, before you think you're getting invited, you might want to have Scott edit out the I eat my steak by the kilo.
Yeah,
yeah, right. yeah.
It's
yeah,
not a, it's not good data to throw out before asking for 300-gram
steaks, please.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. I've done a 72-ounce steak.
Yeah,
no doubt, no doubt.
25.
Your picture on the wall. Was it one of those where you, if you eat it, you get your picture on the wall? Was it one
the
of
old
those?
96er? He went. Oh, man. The great outdoors.
I held the record for a while. Yeah.
I can't eat that. That's just all fat and gristle.
All right. Let's see what else we have here. Like I said, we had a bunch of
them. That's for all the John Candy fans.
Yeah, I loved it. Only you and I actually got that, just for the record.
I didn't get it.
You don't watch films. You wouldn't get anything.
Yeah, I don't watch it. I'm trying to catch up. I've been watching some TV lately. All right. Most common mistake you guys see with quad training. I will sit this one out so we can cut short on time. You know, we can keep this thing rolling. But real quick from each of you.
Just not getting enough depth on everything. Success leaves clues. You know, look at the athletes that have the biggest quads. And they have them by accident because they're not trying to get big quads. But they're Olympic weightlifters who are going ass to heels on all those front squats with elevated heels in those shoes. Sprint cyclists who are putting their knees to their chests with maximum power exertion, and short track speed skaters. Those three athletes have on average, the best quads of all Olympic athletes, and they have the most extreme ranges of motion. They're not even trying to get quad sweep, and they have quad sweep, right? So then you got gyms full of people that are trying to get quad sweep, and they're doing, you know, shitty leg presses, and they're not burying their hack squats, and, you know, they're not taking the leg extension all the way back under the seat, and just everything, you know, full range of motion is like the number one factor. I've seen a lot of stuff where your foot position this way doesn't even really make a difference when it comes to how much more important depth is.
There's absolutely nothing that could be added to that, Scott. You can move on.
Ron just really quick went through all of
yeah.
it.
Yeah, I was like, I got nothing, bro.
All right. Do you want to add anything, Dave?
The only thing I've got is train harder, because most people don't.
Especially if you're
on major.
You're a pussy.
Like, yeah. Well, no, it's just, all right, quick, simple question. Ask yourself this one question. When was the last time you failed squat?
Right.
Yeah.
Dips the bar on the rack. Yeah. Also, I think it's a mistake to do the hero thing and pull the stoppers out. I know guys like to do it for videos, but I would set the stoppers perfectly because if I was training alone, I would take that last negative.
Yeah.
Like I would, you know, I'd get the rep I barely got and then I'd think, okay, there's not another rep. So I'm just going to sit 5-6 second negative and put the bar on the stoppers and climb up from underneath it and re-rack it for my back off set. And that's something I do not see people doing. But that's what it takes. Like, that's what I would do when I was trying to get my legs huge, you know?
All right, question of the week here. Is it bad? And this is from Dusty's Instagram page. Is it bad that during an argument with my missus, all I can think about is when it will be when it will be over so that I can eat?
I see nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, no, that's good. I've had that thought many a time.
All right. How about this one? Have you ever made an online shopping purchase impulsively during prep that made you shake your head after? What was some of your best and worst purchases?
Mine weren't online, but I bought a 7 Series BMW once in prep.
On low carbs.
So there's that.
I mean, a good idea.
You know what I should do right now? What's that? Make a 5-year decision because I'm hungry.
Yeah. Because it feels good.
Yeah. Luckily, my last show was 2015, and I wasn't online shopping nearly as much back then. But I did, I think I just caught the very front end of what would be considered the sneakerhead phase. I had like a slight sneakerhead thing my last few shows where I was ordering online.
Oh.
But I remember reading about other guys and they were making much more severe purchases during prep than I was, you know.
Sneakers didn't seem that bad when people were buying cars. Sneakers
didn't seem that bad. Yeah. Most of my bad purchasing decisions have been made since I stopped competing.
The bike in the background.
Well, the bike gets used. I have too many guitars though.
I've never prepped, so I don't have a problem now. It's okay.
You have no excuse for your bad purchases, huh?
Yeah, you just make them anyways.
Zach Carnes ended up with 3 Bulldogs off 3 preps.
Oh wow!
Oh goodness,
those are good. Those are good decisions. Dogs are always good decisions.
Speaking of which, I have to give a shout out. I put this aside here to these guys. You know these guys, right, Dustin?
Yes, of course. Getting a dog from them shortly.
The Powerful Rescue. They signed up to the Patreon. So I want to say, thank you to them. And look at all these freaking dogs. I just took a screen capture of their page, which they didn't have to sign up to the Patreon for me to do this. I freaking love dogs. But these are all dogs that they have available.
That's my girl right there, bottom right.
Which one? You're kidding me. Right.
That's Nova right there.
You need that bulldog. Someone needs that bulldog. Scott, you need to buy that bulldog.
That bulldog looks amazing.
I believe she's already gone. I can't remember. Yeah. Because they put up their full circle stuff too, which is amazing. If you're not following them, you should, just for purely like if you love dogs. It's amazing.
My Instagram, if you go to my search page, you know, it's dog rescues, guitars, and bikes. There's no more there's hardly any sluts.
Oh.
I know. I'm just
sluts love tired dogs. You.
Tired of sluts. I'm all slutted out. Dusty?
We had a growth question here. We got one that's perfect for Dave. How important is HGH to TRT or a cycle? Some coaches hammer it hard. When do you think it's important to add this in? And what about any substitutes like MK677 or other peptides? Love the podcast and the channel. They knew Dave was coming today.
Yeah. GH, Dave.
Don't really full answer?
For longevity, feel good, youthful sort of vibrancy as a supplement for that market, I'm on board with it. For growing muscle, I just get another bottle of Deca. I wouldn't bother.
There you go.
I find it expensive. I don't find it that particularly productive. It has benefits, but I don't find them primary. I just find them secondary. You know, if I'm looking at what I'm using to get big, growth is definitely not going to be at the top of the list. If I've got more money than sense, fine, I'll try a bit. But, I mean, I've been high, and I didn't really – I struggled to understand what the fuss was about.
You did that GH experiment, didn't you, where you took, like, a massive amount for a long period of time? I can't remember what 20, the numbers were.
27 IU a day.
Pharma.
For how long?
Pharma. A few months.
Pharma. And what was the data? Blah?
Insulin he went broke.
Yeah.
Yep. Insulin resistance and spent a lot of money. I just didn't see the... Now, when I look at growth, low dose, timed correctly, it will add a little bit of polish to what you're doing, so to speak. But I just don't see it as a primary mover in muscle growth at all. Some people will disagree with me. Fine. I'm not that bothered to argue, to be fair. But I just, no, I just don't see it as being the holy grail that it was once thought of being. I find it very useful for cellular rejuvenation, for recovery, for well-being, for general vitality. It's a nice supplement if used low dose. I don't think there's any reason for high dose at any point. But it, like I say, if on my shopping list, it would be very low down.
Yep. Valid.
I just think most guys are better off investing a bit of money.
Bitcoin.
Investing more money sensibly.
Bitcoin. There you go.
Buy a 7 series.
Yeah. Okay, buy growth instead of 7 series. There is one thing better.
Our mobile delivery services like Uber Eats and DoorDash destroying the restaurant service, or are they the best thing since 50 Cent wings?
I never use them.
Really?
Me neither. I don't like burning money.
Yeah, just a ridiculous
thing. I thought everybody was doing it nowadays.
Nah, to me it's just lazy. It's for lazy people.
We do it once in a great while, but it's rare, like super rare.
Yeah, I got a great restaurant my children right across for the that. Street. Yeah,
I'd rather our daughters will do that sometimes and just order, and I'm like, look at, they increase the price of every item,
right?
Then charge you an amount. I'm like, I always joke that things like that are invented for people who are either poor or want to become poor.
Yeah.
Because, like, why? You know, I did this to order this food. I'm like, you have a car.
And doesn't the restaurant make less money? Because
yes,
you're not, your restaurant gets less money out of it. So it's like, screw that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm guilty of using them, but that's only when we're on the road or we're jumping from place to place and we just need to grab some food quick. But that's otherwise, like locally when I'm at home, never use them.
Yeah.
You should be mindful of your local places because I feel like people forget that the people who are spending money in your businesses are local people. You need that money needs to move around. Like Ron can't just take the money from the gym and hold it. He's got to use it around town as well so people can afford to come back to his gym and vice versa.
Yeah.
It's got to be that way.
I try to do everything in my life really near my place and my business. You know what I mean?
That's a great idea. I love that.
Yeah.
Agreed.
Support the community.
What else do we have here? I was going to tell you, I have a friend owns a restaurant locally. He said they're doing like an extra $60,000 because of those apps. That they hadn't done previously, but they, because like Grubhub or whatever charges you something as the business owner, they do, like you said, Dusty, they had to raise their prices. So they're like, we just raised our prices for that stuff.
Yeah. Yep. Which is fine if you're dumb enough to pay for it. I mean, willing to pay for it.
Dusty Hanshaw, explain how nowadays at local shows, you have to look at who won who you won against, because show talent can be weak, that overall wins don't mean you really are at the national level anymore. I think we've talked about this one before, kind of.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty quick. You don't, that's one thing I'll say. I hate that our era and the era before us loved to shit on the current era. That was always a problem. Mm-hmm. Like the shows were bigger, but I mean, I won my first overall with a perfect score overall class and was nowhere near ready for the next level. And the guys were good. It's just the gap is enormous. So it's simple. We live in an age where you can go look at what the next level looks like. Look. No one. I'm not saying you're not ever going to be ready, but you're not ready now. Why spend $3,000 to get your ass kicked? Your wife will do it for free.
Yeah, I agree with Dusty. It was always a thing. Like, you know, I was qualified for nationals for 2 years before I ever went.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I went to nationals the third year I was qualified to go. Because
and how'd that go for you? You did awesome.
I placed second in the men's super heavyweights at only 24 years old.
There you go.
Yeah, but I was just smart enough to know, like, just because you're qualified doesn't mean you should be there.
Yep.
No.
All right, Casey has one for us. He says, if you've only got to splurge funds on one brand of equipment, which would you choose?
Cybex.
It comes down to, like, simplicity, low maintenance, simplicity of design, and the footprint size are the three main things I look at. So you're looking at hammer strength, kills everyone on the maintenance.
Yeah, there it goes.
It's the lowest maintenance equipment ever made. The plate-loaded hammer strength is by far, you don't have to touch it for like 35 years. And Cybex is probably kills everybody on footprint, and simplicity is there, and the maintenance is very low. So it's a fantastic brand. There's a couple others that are great, but it's really hard to nail all three of those. You know that old saying, you can have light, strong, cheap. You get two of those. You get to pick two. Right? Light, strong, cheap. Pick two, because you can't have all three. It's kind of like, you know, low maintenance, small footprint, simplicity of design, you know? I'd say Cybex, which is now gone. They're rolling a bunch of those designs into the Life Fitness brand. So some of those pieces are still going to be available with a Life Fitness sticker on them.
Yeah.
And then hammer strength. Yeah.
How about you, Dave? What do you guys have over there that you like?
You know, the best kit I've ever trained on was made by the bloke who owns a gym.
Yeah, you guys have like a lot of homemade stuff over there, don't you?
It was made by a bodybuilder for bodybuilders. It's the best kit I've ever used. It's 40 odd years old now. It's still brilliant. Not only did it just do it right, and I can't give you any other explanation than that, but I mean, his lat pull down had a 350-pound stack. His calf machine was 1,050 pounds.
Oh God!
Yeah,
it was just built right. I've never got into the big brand thing. I've trained on some beautiful kit, but I couldn't tell you what it was. I just got on it. It felt right. I used it. It didn't feel right. I moved on to the next one. I never got it, and I it's almost a subculture now. Gym equipment. It's also a bit like sneakerheads. There's people that tour from gym to be able to use that Cybex leg press or that particular, you know, Watson piece or Arsenal piece or whatever. And I don't get it because I don't know the brands in relation to the equipment. I just know what felt right.
There's a lot of gimmicky stuff now.
And if it wasn't like I couldn't justify it, I guess is what I'm getting at. But if it wasn't the cost factor, I would get a bunch of Jim Leko stuff because I could have like an entire gym in my basement because it would all
fit. Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, they've got some great pieces, definitely. And, you know, you see, I look on Instagram and you'll see somebody doing a row and they got like six plates aside on it and they're not like dusty. They're just like a regular dude. And I think, well, that's a piece of shit machine because it's just eating plates. Like there's no reason some, you know, 190 pound dude should be doing six plates on a row machine. Like it makes no sense. So it's poorly designed plate eating machines and they're just novelties and gimmicks and they make people feel great because they post it on Instagram. But
that's the problem though. They become the most popular machine in your gym because everybody can look strong on it. You want the one that taxes you the most, not the one that makes it as easy as possible for you.
I love it when I get on a row and I can only do two or three plates. I'm like, oh, this is a good row.
I don't have to move so much weight to get started on this thing.
Remember Dino's row? That old row at Dino's?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Jesus. Yeah.
That was a great one, the red one that we did. Yeah, we got video. That's great.
All right. What are some of the moments where you felt that you were being the most hardcore?
When I started and I carried a gallon of water around like an idiot. I learned about liters later in life and convenience and cup holders.
I had a bunch of bandanas.
Yeah.
I had a bunch of bandanas and boat neck shirts and
hey. Yep. That's a little close to home.
Yeah, we saw Dusty's new boat neck. That looked good, man. Loved it. Got the tramps out.
How was that cut? That was a one and done cut. I was so proud of myself when I put it on. I was like, I look like I went back to the 90s. I saw kids looking at me confused.
It was trap tip to trap tip. It couldn't have been a better cut.
There we go. Look at that, guys.
That was a magical moment when I cut that thing up. I'm like, look at that. I actually kept the strip to show Nikki. I was like, just so you know, I did this in one shot. So
nice. Incline presses and shrugs all day long.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There was a judgment free. I thought the gym was funny because I felt like all the older guys understood what was happening.
Yeah.
Like they were like, oh boy. I think head nods and maybe a slight like,
Yeah. And I like how you chose to go no stringer. You just went just boat neck. I used to do that a lot too. You don't need the stringer. The stringer's just like, you know, it's a nice accessory occasionally.
Yeah.
No, I disagree. You need the stringer because you need the stringer for the strip down halfway through the workout.
You're going to do the tarps off. Yeah.
Yeah, you're going to do the layer. You're going to do the layer. So it's full hoodie first because you're covered up and it's over your head. So no one, because you're mean and moody. Then that comes off.
Mean and moody.
Then that comes off and it's full stringer to finish.
Oh, that's terrible.
I love it. That's my new catchphrase, mean and moody. Okay.
What do you guys think about guys who hit a vacuum instead of hitting their abs while doing their mandatories?
So like the judges call ab thigh and they do a vacuum?
Yeah.
Blows my mind. I don't understand it.
If it's a good vacuum. If it's a good vacuum.
Well, so what I tell guys is hit the ab thigh. Blow it out. Blow everybody's minds with the ab thigh. Make sure you see the judges all stare at how great your abs are. And then if you want to pull up into a vacuum and get the crowd pop, you can do that. But if I was a judge, I'd be looking for your abs. And if you're not going to show me your abs, then you lose that pose. That's my mindset. Right. It's an ab thigh. If they go front double by and they don't go like this, then how do you judge their front double by, right?
Yeah.
My biggest bugbear when I judge is people doing dumb shit and over elaborating transitions into poses and waving their arms like they're trying to fucking fly or they've just about to dump a hot shit. It's just like, get into the pose, do it, and hook off.
Dave, you forgot we don't do swears, Dave. You totally forgot.
You never said.
I love it.
Why can you do? Why could you do swears on this show and you can't do swears on our show?
Oh boy!
You never told me I couldn't swear.
You did a lot of swears today.
Don't mind him, Dave.
He gives me a list of what I'm allowed to do and not allowed to do, and there was no swearing on that list.
There's always no swearing on the list.
This is absolutely one of our shorts right here. Dave dropping him the whole time, and Scott yelling at him,
and Ron doing a good. Ron did a good job today. If Dave could be more like Ron, we would have a good thing going here.
Be That's more like Ron, say. Dave. This is how he mad said, your not, life has gotten.
I'm not allowed to use the R word.
No, you're definitely not. We learned that last week, didn't we?
Well, I learned it. We might not have learned it.
What lesson did we learn, Dave? You're talking to him like he's in kindergarten.
You shouted at me for it. Told me off last week. Again.
Oh boy, this is fantastic.
While we have you here, Dave, I expressly wanted to have you here to tell us a story about being a bouncer. Because I learned a whole other side of Dave. I'd heard some bouncing stories before, but when I came out to visit, Dave moved, but he lived in a little village, just like you would imagine in northern England. It was literally like cobblestone roads and stuff like that, little tiny village in the middle of nowhere. And one day we were eating food, and he told me all about how, what was it? You said that you weren't necessarily the hardest puncher, but you could definitely take a hard hit. No doubt.
Look at that noggin.
You didn't go down. What was that ashtray story you told us about?
Right. So, yeah, I can't really punch for toffee, but I can grab people, and I used to restrict their oxygen flow, was always found it to be very effective. But I could always take a good punch. Probably with growing up with two brothers that were older than me and liked to use me as a punch bag, I sort of got used to it. But I was working a charity music festival, a low-key thing, nothing, not big, no known names or anything like that, just local bands, local pub, local fields. And these two gentlemen that like to use drugs that made them look unwell decided they were going to try and gain entry through the field. So we met them and informed them that they wouldn't be allowed to gain entry through the field and that they wouldn't be welcome because we basically didn't want their sort at the event. So one of them decided to introduce my head to a £10 lump hammer. And he caught me at the back here and opened it up. At that point, obviously, we all had a little bit of a dance and we hugged each other a little bit.
A little straightener?
No, I hugged him a little bit and explained to him that he was doing something that wasn't very nice and not very friendly and he shouldn't really do it.
It wouldn't be acceptable.
No, so I guided him to the front of the venue where the intention was that the local constabulary were going to be informed. And I just restrained him gently while my colleagues brought his two colleagues up through the field as well. Now, if you've ever seen a dry stone wall, it's basically a wall made out of stones that are piled on top of each other. It's a very, very skilled job. And then for a top, what they do is they put a stone on its edge. So the top of the wall is these quite big, you know, they'll be this size pieces of stone, about 2.5-3 inches thick, in a sort of half curve shape-ish, roughly, and they make the top of the wall. So I was distracted by his two colleagues disagreeing with my colleagues in the field. I turned round to him having hold of this stone in both hands and him literally wiping it across the side of my head in one foul swoop. That then restricted my vision slightly. Unfortunately, the blood meant I couldn't see very well. But I knew he was in front of me, so I grabbed him and pinned him by his breathing apparatus to the wall at the side of the pub. We did have some on-site dogs.
Actual dogs.
Yeah, dogs. And I remember.
I didn't know if that was like a British word.
You mean
for
like dags?
Your friends,
yeah, like,
or something.
Like dags. So Bob the dog was the name of the handler, and he was well known for his dogs. He may or may not have introduced a mild anabolic cycle to a couple of his animals.
I heard of people doing that.
His Rottweiler may have dragged a Suzuki Jimny down the field in the middle of the night when he was chained to it. And he introduced this animal to this gentleman's arm and then he proceeded to run around the car park with him in his mouth. by this point, things are getting a little bit nuts. Everything's going a bit crazy.
Yeah, it was really normal up until the dog.
Yeah. It's gone fairly sensible to this
point.
Probably
a typical trip to Target to me at that point.
And then one of them got into the pub. I blocked the other two's entry from the pub. And one of them ran up and punched me in the face. And then the one that got in the pub behind me came out behind me. And in the English pubs, we have these big pot ashtrays. They're about this big. Big ceramic ashtrays. And he came up behind me and smashed that over the top of my head.
Your poor head.
No sense, no feeling. The police did eventually arise. And obviously it was expressed that I would like to press charges against these gentlemen for the several holes that are now profusely pumping blood out of my noggin, and they informed me that the gentlemen wanted to press charges for their lack of teeth and an inability to use their arm anymore because the dog had just had him to pieces. And as a result, it went nowhere, and we went knock for knock, so to speak. But, yeah, that were an interesting evening.
Damn. Now, no. I bounced at some bars, but I don't ever remember having Rottweilers on staff.
Yeah, right?
That's really another level.
They don't do that in Canada.
I've never been hit with a piece of a building before either.
Right, part of a wall.
And why was it loose?
Yeah. They are loose. It's dry stone. They're not made with any cement. They just sat on top.
For use of bouncers. What was in this bar that they wanted in so bad? I mean, you said it was an average band. I mean, damn.
Yeah. The band was in the field. The bar had nothing to do with the actual event. The event was in some tents in the field, and the dogs were literally there for the nighttime shift, like when it all closed down, to protect the band equipment and the sound equipment and stuff like that.
Oh, damn.
So, and then the bar was just serving food and drinks to the event. So they had like an outside bar and an inside bar as well. Oh, there's been all sorts over the years. I remember... I got stabbed by somebody, and that ended up in a physical brawl, and that was quite a nasty one. And there was blood appearing on this gentleman's head, which I felt was coming from him, and I was quite encouraged by this situation. I felt that justice was being served, and this gentleman was getting what he deserved. Until I actually realized it wasn't his; it was mine.
Oh,
and it was just. Out of my chest.
Oh my god.
we don't damn. Bounce like that in the United States. It's different.
Yeah.
Oh man, no, honestly, there's all sorts
maybe
of
in Detroit things. But
yeah,
that's like not every Scottsdale.
Yeah. I saw some brawls in my day, and like, you know, I did have a couple of good headbutt stories, but nothing compared to that.
No. Damn.
I've had shotguns pulled on me, shotguns fired at me, knives pulled on me, tried to be run over.
What do you get paid to bounce over there?
I think you're underpaid drastically for knives, guns, bricks.
You had your own business. Dave had his own business.
I had a whole bouncing crew. And one of the things we specialized in was clearing out shitholes, basically making bad pubs good. There's been some funny stuff over the years as well. There always is. I remember end of a club. This was very early in my bouncing days. We found a gentleman in the toilet who still had his pants around his ankles. And I'm not sure how it had occurred, but there was several people's urine and feces all over this guy. he was a mess, and he stunk. So we had to get him out of the building. We couldn't leave him where he was. The ambulance wouldn't take him. The police wouldn't take him. So we grabbed whatever we could in the way of toilet roll and beer towels to pick him up with and sort of carry him out. And the police has said, throw him in the back of the van. We'll take him down to the cell. We'll get the duty doctor down to check he's all right, and he can just sleep it off in the cell. And we got him halfway across the road when Nick, who one of the lads I was working with, dropped his guts, and it stunk. And we just dropped this guy in the middle of the road and ran off because he just smelled so bad. And just left him in the middle of the road where he was with his pants around his ankle, covered in shit and piss.
Dropped his guts. Do you mean he like threw up?
Puked.
No, he farted. No, oh. Nick farted.
Oh. I didn't know the meaning. I thought that meant puked.
Yeah, I did too. What did you win? You're like, that's it. This fart is too much.
It just stunk. It was vile. So we just you just said the guy had ran off.
Feces all over him, and it was his fart that ended it.
Yeah.
God. Wow. What does that
it's
guy
too
eat?
Much. You got to draw the line somewhere.
Yeah, I guess so.
I agree. Just, you know, there's no need. I could go on and on and on. Those
if we had time for all the stories, Dave also owned like a monster truck and gave people rides in that. He's also told us stories about how, so Dave's done a little time. He's talked about that on the shows. And for a while he lived in Canada, Ron. He lived in Canada alongside you. But you weren't supposed. Was that when you weren't supposed to be in? Like you were still.
WITSAC.
You were like Dave didn't want to get in trouble, so he went to Canada, kind of thing.
I lived in Port Dover.
Yeah, for a while.
Yeah, no, funny. I lived in. I moved over. I went in Toronto, then I went to Hamilton, and I was in Hamilton when there was the big kickoff with the Indians over. Some houses that were supposedly being built on reservation land or Indian land. And right. the developer had bought the land off the council, and the council had supposedly bought it off the chief. And the Indians were saying he, one, didn't have the right to sell the land because they don't believe in ownership, and two, it was just an X on a piece of paper and they couldn't prove it was him. So for literally, I think it was about 2 years, they occupied this land. They built a makeshift sort of fort almost on it. And they occupied it for months. It was in all the news for a very long time.
You remember what year that was? I remember that. I can't remember what year that was.
2005, somewhere on there. Yeah. And then I moved to Port Dover, and I lived on the shores of Lake Erie on Port Dover for about 6 months.
And okay. Then you went home for a couple of years.
Then I went on holiday for 4 years.
Holiday for 4 years.
There you go.
Oh, yeah. Have we got time to tell one story?
Of course.
So I was held at Niagara Detention Center, and then I got moved to Toronto West 1, which is a very unpleasant prison, I might add.
That's after they figured out who you were at this point.
That's after they realized who I was, yes. And so I was being deported, and basically you're a prisoner till you get to the airport, then you get put in civvy clothes, you meet a marshal who takes you through into the departure lounge, and then you just board the plane like anybody else, and it's the country you're going back to responsibility to arrest you if they want you at that end. So it must have been these guys' first day, I don't know. Full orange jumpsuit, top and bottom shackles, chain linking, the whole works, proper chain gang job. I'm shuffling out of prison into this van. I get to the airport, they're supposed to take me down to the customs door away from the public so I can get changed into civilian clothes. They didn't. They walked me up to the check-in desk, still shackled, still in chains, still in the orange jumpsuit, and they checked me in. There was a woman at the check-in desk next to me looking incredibly nervous about this big bloke with a bald head and a beard in chains being checked onto the flight that she's about to board. Then I get taken to customs. These two security guards get the rollicking of their lives. I'm allowed to get changed, and I meet the marshal, and he checks me through to the departure round, and he's like, yeah, go get a coffee, do what you want. And I'm just sat and chatting, shooting the shit. And he was great. He gave me my documents and my passport and said, right, you board the plane. Hand them in when you board the plane. And off you go, you know, hope I never see you again sort of thing. So I get a whole row in the middle of the plane to myself.
Nice.
There's no one near me. I've got the whole row out to myself. I'm sat in this row, and on the end row, because obviously you've got the two aisles, you've got the seats by the windows, an aisle, middle row, aisle, seats by the window. This woman that was at the check-ins now sat opposite me on the same row, but in the window seat.
Yeah, she saw you in your orange jumpsuit.
She's now looking across at me, thinking, "What the? This guy's here. He was there in the jumpsuit. Why is he on the plane? Why is he sat near me?
Why doesn't he have shackles on?"
And so we do the flight. We land in England. I get off the plane. I've got my documentation. I decided I needed to go to the toilet, so I went to the toilet. Then I came out and I walked down to passport control, and I'm in the domestic line for entering the UK. And there's five armed officers at the bottom of this queue. And one of them walks up. Now, they all have machine guns at the airport. So one of them walks up and he's on his radio next to me. And I step out, I give him my passport, and I go, "I think you're looking for me, mate." And he's like, yeah, just come with us. I went, okay, no problem. And then all of a sudden, this guy turns up puffing and panting. Apparently, he'd got up the plane to meet me and missed me because I'd gone in the toilet. So now I've got six armed police officers around me. I'm cuffed. And I'm like, look, I've got luggage to collect. Okay, no problem. We'll go get your luggage. Okay, so they walk me down to the carousel. So I'm now stood at the carousel, surrounded by, cuffed again, surrounded by six armed police officers with machine guns. the coppers to get my luggage off the carousel, and this woman stood next to us now at the carousel. At this point, she just about has a heart attack.
This is amazing.
So she definitely had a tale to tell her grandkids anyway. Yeah. But yeah, she definitely had a nervous flight, I think.
Yeah. I didn't know it worked that way. And just for anybody else that doesn't know Dave's story, it was for taxes.
Yeah, it was like, VAT. Yeah. No, it was VAT. Well, receipt of stolen vehicles and VAT fraud was what I got done with.
Damn.
And that's and Toronto, what made that lady's and flight so uncomfortable.
Toronto prison was worse than England.
No, it wasn't as bad as Shots. Shots is a dump. But Toronto wasn't pleasant. I was in with a mad Russian that killed coppers. A big fat accountant from New Zealand who had failed to surrender account information on one of his clients and was doing a connecting flight, didn't realize it was doing a stopover in the States. So he had a warrant outstanding because he hadn't failed to provide his evidence for the American courts. So he was in there waiting whatever was going on with him. So he wasn't really in there because he committed a proper crime. He was awaiting what they were going to do about him not surrendering this information.
Yeah.
And a young lad who was in for several murders.
Nice.
Who just constantly spoke about how his girlfriend and how she was going to wait for him and she was going to be there for him when he got out. Obviously, we all knew very different. But I wasn't going to tell him that. I wanted to wake up in the morning. So, yeah, it was an interesting cell that the four have shared with them four strange individuals.
Damn. Oh, man. Yeah, that whole transport prisoner thing, you see it in movies and you wonder how it actually goes, you know?
Yeah. I thought now they had the marshal with you or something, you know?
Yeah, just kind of a fumbled handoff all the time.
Yeah.
I think it depends on, obviously, the offense you've committed. I mean, mine's classed as a white-collar crime, so I don't think they had any concerns about me flying. I think if you were a multiple murderer, you might fly in cuffs with a marshal with you. I think that might be slightly different.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, by the way, guys, if you want to listen to the unedited, the unbeeped version of this episode, you can do that at Rumble.
Because there's going to be a lot of beeps, apparently.
There's going to be a few beeps.
Why is there going to be beeps? I don't understand.
There's certain words.
Show him the bomb, Ron. Show him the bomb.
I didn't say nothing. I didn't say nothing wrong.
I don't think so either. I'm all about liberty.
That's right.
Take it that, I know. Is that the fart bomb then? That's for farting, is it?
It's similar.
Yeah.
Similar.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, thanks for coming on, Dave. I really appreciate the stories. The ashtray capped it for me. It's good to finally have a long form discussion with you. You know, obviously, I've watched a lot of I let the podcast play in the background quite often, and I appreciate your insight into being extraordinarily massive. Throw that picture up one more time, Scott.
We can do that right here.
I mean, you know, you can say all you got to say, but 400 pounds is still 400 pounds. So thanks for coming on, Dave Crossland, co-host of Drugs and Stuff. You can catch what days your show always come out?
We always put it on Mondays.
Mondays. So it's out while we're recording right now. People are watching the new episode of Drugs and Stuff. Okay, thanks, Dave. Remember, everybody, like, share, subscribe, comment, and
ring that bell.
Yes, sir. Remember, IamMutant.com, Born Hardcore, get your isosurge, get your all in, and everybody should get on the gear. Dusty 20, Big Run 20. Okay, thanks, everybody, and remember, it's just bodybuilding.